Hi, my name is Sean, and I'm an alcoholic. And that's the end of the facts. All the rest of this stuff is my opinion, and I'm not a spokesman for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not an expert on alcoholism. But I got some opinions. I want to thank the committee for asking us to be here. I'd travel any length to spend 5 days in a great hotel with a good-looking blonde. I mean, this is just terrific. We're having a wonderful time here. It's you really know how to do a convention, let me tell you. My home group was the Wednesday Ambleside group in West Vancouver, but we changed it to Thursday, so now it's the Thursday Ambleside group. So if you're looking for it, and I've got some old friends here. This is just terrific. I just really want it. And a gathering of miracles is a great thing. I wished I knew what the hell I was going to talk about. Before I get up at these things, I always say, okay, God, you know, I'll move my lips and you do the talking, and I'm always surprised at what comes up. If you're wondering what this kind of thing is I've been asked to share at conventions before, and I just want you to know if you think this is really a hot thing to do. Let me tell you that what I'm involved in here is probably the least important 12-step work there is. I mean, it's real easy for me to look real good in West Palm Beach, Florida, because you're not going to see me Monday at work or Tuesday on the freeway or Wednesday in my home, you know. So it's real easy to look kind of spiffy. The most important 12-step work, of course, is the kind that we get to do less and less, it seems these days, is getting to talk one-on-one with some drunk who's trying to get sober. And that's the most exciting thing, and that's what we're here to do. And I want to welcome the guy with 4 days, wherever he is. God, 4 days. I've been sober 21 years, 3 months, and 3 days, and I never want to be 4 days sober again as long as I live. I mean, that was the worst experience of my life. You know? There are lots of reasons that I stay sober, lots and lots of reasons. But one of them is I never want to have to shake it out in rooms like this with half a cup of coffee again. And I was one of the groups that did that. I got sober before the insurance companies and the medical profession found out we were big business. And we shook it out in basements like this that were filled with smoke, and they gave us half a cup of coffee because we spilled a lot. It's been an incredible journey for me. It's been an incredible journey for me. But let me tell you what it was like. Well, you come to with a sharp intake of breath, and you're not sure what time it is or where you are. And it takes you a couple of minutes to get your eyeballs unstuck because you had your contact lenses in for 36 hours. And you crawl to the John, and you pee or you throw up, and it doesn't matter which one is first. And then you turn on the water as hot as you can get it in the shower, and you get in and you boil yourself for 3/4 of an hour. Hoping that you can wash away some of the stuff that you remember vaguely. And you wash your hair. I always wash my hair. I thought clean hair was kind of like, you know, made it all right. You can always tell the drunk's bathroom because the paint's peeling off the ceiling because we spend so much time in the shower trying to get clean. But once I get out of the shower and dry off, I couldn't shave yet. But I had some rules that you never drank before 5 o'clock because your old man's a drunk, and if you drink before 5, you're a drunk. And so I'd check the medicine cabinet and see what was there, and I would take a combination of things that would calm me down and get me going. And I take the things, you know, and I get them. I was experimenting with the combination all the time because the circumstances kept changing. But you get enough in you that you can kind of calm down enough to shave. I always had an assortment of styptics, you know. Frequently, I looked like the victim of a botched suicide attempt after trying to shave. And you get it together and you get dressed. Now, I was a very neat drunk because it was important to look good. And I'd get dressed and get to the kitchen and open the refrigerator, and there'd be a bottle of vodka chilling and some yogurt that you bought 4 months ago. But it didn't matter because it was starting to kick in and you weren't hungry by then. You were getting a little jumpy. because the amphetamines were starting to work. So you go back to the bathroom and you take one of the downers to kind of take the edge off, and then you get in the car and get to work. And it's good that the amphetamines are working because you only have 10 minutes to get to work. And you come flying into work and start with coffee. And by 10 o'clock, you just, I don't know about you, but I was always kind of just a little nervous about 10 o'clock, just a little jumpy. Right there. Yeah. And you do 2 weeks' work by noon. And you get to go to lunch and the other guys would have a beer. But if you're like me, you didn't dare have a beer because you've had a beer, you didn't get back to work. Because once I had that drink, it was gone, you know, and I knew that. And I always envied those guys who could have a beer and go back to work. But by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it was starting to wear down. You needed to take another one of those things to get you back up again. And by 4:30, it had kicked in. You were getting a little too wired, you know. So you take another one of those things to kind of keep it calm, you know. And then it was 5 o'clock and it was okay. Then you could have the drink, you know. The drink that gave you the choice. Now, I heard when I first came here that it was the first drink that got you drunk, but that was not true in my case, I thought. The first drink was the one that gave me the choice, you know, of whether I was going to drink or not. Once you get that first belt down, you know, just that one and it hits, then you got that moment where you can go. Maybe I'll have a drink. Oh, what the hell. By 6 o'clock, I was drunk. By 6:30, 7 o'clock, I'd slipped into a blackout, and I did whatever I did until I passed out or it stopped at 11, 12, 1, 2, whatever it was. And then you come to with a sharp intake of breath, and you don't know what time it is or where you are. And your eyeballs are stuck together because you had your contact lenses in all night. And that's the good part. That's how it was going when it was going okay. And I had those real bad days and those real good days, you know, and that's just the way it was. And I don't know how I got there, you know. And God, what happened? How did it get this enormous this fast? How did it happen, you know? Because I was just an average kind of guy, you know. I came from a normal alcoholic home. My father was a drunk. My mother was a saint. I came from a dysfunctional family. One of those folk therapist guys, you know, who talk about all that stuff, said that 90% of the families in America are dysfunctional. So I guess that makes it normal. You know, I never found any of the 10%, but my family was just like that, and I knew about drinking. I knew that my father changed when he drank. And I stashed that away because when I needed to change, when I hit 14, when everybody needs to change, I had a solution to that. I hit 14 and puberty looked real, real tough to me. I mean, it looked grisly, so I skipped it. I was tall, I was fat, I had thick glasses, crooked teeth, and I was weird. And I was extremely uncomfortable, and when I was 14, I found comfort. Southern comfort is what I found. And I loved the burn all the way down, and I liked the burn all the way up. I mean, it just felt really good. You know, it was smooth going down and chunky coming up, and that was fine with me. And the first time I got drunk, I came 2 hours later throwing up under a bush, and I'd had a hell of a good time, they told me, and I could hardly wait to do it again. When I was 17 years old, my mother became concerned that I was working too hard during exam time. She gave me one of her diet pills. God bless that woman. And I added that to my regimen. And by the time I was 18 years old, I declared myself an alcoholic, and I didn't know that I had done it, but I said the phrase that only an alcoholic says. If you're here and you're not sure that you belong here, if you've ever said this phrase, you belong here. If you've ever heard anybody say it, you're listening to a drunk, and the phrase is, I can control my drinking. Only an alcoholic says that. Non-alcoholics and social drinkers never deal with that concept. Social drinkers, if they make a fool of themselves whilst drinking, they stop drinking. Have you ever noticed that? Isn't that weird? Can you imagine? If But I was 18 years old, and I was in trouble with the chemicals. But the prospect of living without them was terrifying, and that's alcoholism. And so I started on the great obsession of every abnormal drinker, to control and enjoy my drinking. Now, I don't know about you, but I never got control and enjoy in the same room at the same time. I mean, I just couldn't get them together. I mean, they just were not like bookends for me, you know? I mean, when I was controlling my drinking, I was miserable. You know, now I don't want you to get the idea that I ever quit drinking. From the time I was 14 years old until the night before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I drank. I never controlled my drinking. I was raised in a large Irish Catholic family, and they were always swearing off for Lent or taking the pledge, and they were always drunk a week later, so it looked senseless to me. So when I was controlling it, I was not having any fun at all. Because the only way I like to drink is totally out of control, man. That's what I do it for, you know? I want you to know that the reason I'm standing here today is that I love to drink. I loved everything about it. I love the taste. I love the ice cubes. I love the toothpicks with the garbage on them. I love coconut shells with umbrellas. I love those intense intellectual conversations we got into at bars, you know? I love reappointing the Supreme Court, you know? I love those meaningful relationships that sometimes lasted all night. I loved it. I just loved it. I mean, you know, the way I drank is stark naked howling at the moon. Whoa! I mean, that's the kind of drunk you're looking at, you know? I didn't sip a little sherry, burn the toast, and get here. I loved it. And I did it for as long as I could, man. I just loved it because I don't know about you. People from this podium talk about drinking stopped working for them. I don't know what that is. See, if it had ever stopped working for me, I'd have stopped doing it. It never stopped working for me. There was always that moment. From the first time I drank to the last time I drank. There was a moment, it may have been 4 drinks in, 6 drinks in with a little grass and a little upper. It may have been, you know, 2 drinks in and a little, you know, something, but you know, whatever the combination was. But there was a moment when suddenly, you know, I was tough, but tender. Intellectual, but down to earth. A great dancer and fast with my fists. A poet and a tough guy. A great lover. Sexy with a touch of cruelty. Man, I was everything I needed to be. It was just, you know? And then that thing in like Star Trek, you know, when they hit warp speed, it was whoosh, and it was 2 hours later, and there were 5 people standing around going, and I'd done it again, you know? You know? Yeah. Oh, man. But that always happened to me. Every time I drank, I had that moment, and oh, God, I love that moment. Because the rest of my life was nothing like that. The rest of my life, I was scared. I was less than. I was constantly apologizing and overcompensating for myself. I mean, I was not a happy camper, man, you know? And, boy, did drinking work. Phew. The only trouble with it is that I started paying a higher and higher price for that moment. And eventually what happened is the price crushed me. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And along the way I did a lot of things to avoid coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, let me tell you. I was highly successful in several of the things that I did. I married above my station. I had a house in the Hollywood Hills. I drove a classic Mercedes. That's an old Mercedes. I had a pedigree dog. I had just enough stuff to look like that wasn't the problem, that it wasn't drinking, you know? The only trouble was is that every night I was in a blackout. And And it was terrifying. And on April 23rd, 1974, I was arrested by the West Hollywood Vice Squad on a sleazy little charge. I don't think the Hugh Grant story is funny at all. Got me sober. I hope it does the same for him. I was taken down and fingerprinted and photographed and released on my own recognizance, and I went home with the front of my pants from the waistband to the knees soaked in my own urine, and it got my attention. Now, a wonderful thing happened that night. What had happened was that Bonnie wasn't there. My little pre-Al-Anon was out in Orange County saving somebody who didn't need to be saved, and I was absolutely by myself and had to deal with the consequences of what I had done. If she'd have been there, we'd have worked out somehow that it was their fault. But it wasn't. It was my fault, and I had to look at that, and that moment of clarity came in my life. And I'm really glad that I grabbed at that moment, because what happens is it only lasts a very short time with us, you know? And sometimes that moment can cloud back over and it never happens again. I realized at some kind of deep, deep level that I had been washed ashore from a storm. And that if I did not act at this very, very moment, I would be swept out to sea again. And I saw very, very clearly a lot of things about myself. I saw that there was an enormous gap between who I was and who I wanted to be. I've always known the kind of man I wanted to be. I've always known it. I was raised with morals. I was raised in a religion. I was raised with what was right and wrong. I've known that. We all know that. I mean, you scratch the surface of any drunk, you'll find a prude. We are the most uptight, self-judgmental, self-loathing people in the world. I mean, thank God we're not running countries. You know? The problem was is that because of my drinking and using, I had lived outside of my own moral boundaries for a very, very long time. I came here with a great burden of guilt for a very simple reason. I was guilty. You know, no question. I was living a life that I didn't approve of. I realized that I had committed suicide of the soul. And it had happened a long time ago. You know, the extent of my spiritual life before I got to this fellowship were the two alcoholic prayers. The first one is, "Dear God, get me out of this and I will never do it again." And the second alcoholic prayer is, "Whew." There was a woman I was working with. She had 6 years of sobriety. And I really liked what she had. She was just kind of sailing through life. I mean, she had good days and bad days, but she could handle stuff that were just a little beyond me. And on April 24th, 1974, I said the last phrase. I said to her at 11 o'clock in the morning, "I'm an alcoholic, and I got 20 minutes before I go to pieces." And I thank God for the people who've got time in this fellowship, because she heard the screaming. She understood that I lived with a ball of screaming in my chest. In the good days, sat in the middle of my chest. On the bad days, it got up behind my throat. And those are the days that when you have a flat tire or a broken shoelace, or you get rained on, it'll slip past your vocal cords and you'll scream and you'll scream and you'll scream and you can't stop screaming, and it'll take you someplace and it won't bring you back. And I lived like that. I knew what that was. I lived right on the edge of breaking all the time, you know. I know what it's like to pull myself together, you know, to get it together just enough to get through your goddamn life. I know what that's like. I knew about one day at a time a long time before I got here. I lived in 24-hour compartments a long time before I got here, because there weren't any more dreams. There weren't any more hopes. They were just get through it, man, and don't let them know that you're about to die. And she heard that. She heard that in that little phrase. And she dropped everything, and she 12-stepped me. She took me to her apartment. She sat me down at her dining room table. She got the big book out. She slapped it down on the dining room table. I thought, my God, that woman is going to read that entire book to me. She did read chapter 5, chapter 3, and the 12 traditions, and I thought, she is going to read it all to me, you know. She got me some orange juice and Carol syrup, and I could still taste it to this day. She said it would help calm me down, and it did. And she told me her story. And the first miracle happened. I mean, my story was sleazy, but hers was disgusting. You know? We talked about drinking. And I explained to her that I realized that the drinking was the problem. You know, that it was definitely the problem. And what I felt I should do was kind of stop drinking and kind of drift into sobriety on a little pink cloud of Valium. You know, just kind of touch down kind of lightly, you know, because I knew that withdrawal was going to kill me. And, you know, I was so toxic. And 21 years ago, 3 months and 3 days ago, this woman looked at me and said, in Southern California, we define sobriety as clean and sober. And I said, what the hell does that mean? And she said, that means we don't drink and we don't take any self-administered mind-altering chemicals. I was real disappointed at that news. So I have been clean and sober ever since that day. And I really thank God that she asked the questions and she found out and told me that. Because I'm one of those guys that it had all gotten mixed up together. And if somebody hadn't made that very, very clear to me, I may not have made it. I may not have made it. And so I came to my first meeting shaking and jumping and whipping and jangling and woohoo. I mean, I was just a little quick when I got here. Just a little, zippy. And I went to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. It was exactly as I was afraid it was going to be. It was in a church basement, it had gray walls, low ceiling. It was filled with smoke. And all those people that I never would have drank with were there. And we had real big meetings in Hollywood, California. And that one had about 400 people. And it must have been a real slow night. Because it was like being dropped into a shark tank. I'd never seen so many teeth coming at me in my life. And it's, hi! I mean, you were real glad to see me. Now, I had done my best to look really good. I had come directly from work. Yeah. I didn't have any insurance, so I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I got to tell you, it's possible to be sober from the first day you get here. Without insurance, you know. This has been my therapy since that day. And I had a little... Let me tell you how I arrived. If you're thinking about getting your act together and drifting on out of here, I came in... This is 1974. I had a $250 sports jacket from Saks Fifth Avenue. I had French gabardine slacks, Italian loafers, and a designer tie. I'd been paid $300 for a day's work as a model about a week before I got here. I looked fabulous. I was 6'2". I weighed 155 pounds. I looked wonderful. I walked into that meeting and everybody knew that I was a drunk and I couldn't figure that out. Other than that, I was with this blabbermouth that was telling everybody. But there were a couple of things that were going on that night that I wasn't aware of. One of them was that I had been drinking straight vodka the night before. It was a rather warm night like it is now. And I had on a lot of lemon-lime cologne and I smelled like a gimlet. And the other thing was that I had newcomer eyes. Now, the only other place I've ever seen eyes like that, other than on a newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous, are on a dog loose on a freeway. I was just terrified, you know? I had that god-awful combination that so many of us come in with. I was terrified and cynical at the same time, you know? We either come in here raging angry or just terrified. It's the flip side of the same thing, you know. I was to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous long enough to find out that anger is not a real emotion. That anger is a learned response to a real emotion, and it's a learned response that I learned when I was a child. And it's a response to fear. I've never liked being afraid. I don't know who is crazy about it. Hands up. Who likes being afraid? Not me, man. You know? But when I was real young, I learned that if you got angry, you didn't feel fear. And from that time on, whenever I started to get scared, I'd get angry. And the response time got shorter and shorter and shorter to the point where I couldn't tell the difference. The point where I was angry all the time. But I'm a coward, so you don't act angry. You know, you just feel angry and you act cool. And so I was like a time bomb ready to explode. The wonderful thing about staying here long enough to learn the 12 steps and to apply the 12 traditions in your life is you learn stuff about myself. And what I learned is how to break that response, that anger response. When I start feeling it come on to say, hold it, wait a minute, what am I afraid of? And what I find out, of course, is that I'm afraid of one or two things. Either that I'm going to lose something that I perceive that I own, or that I'm not going to own something that I perceive that I need, you know. And so that first night was, it was terrifying, it was exhilarating, and I thought that I loved Alcoholics Anonymous from the moment I got here, and that's not true. What happened was that first night I felt safe. I felt understood and accepted. For the first time in my life, I looked around at all these weird people and thought, my God, I belong here. I mean, these are the ones I've been looking for all my life. I met the man who was to become my sponsor that night, and he started teaching me the steps. There were several miracles that happened that night. One of them was that I was struck stupid. And I'm real grateful for that, because I'm a real bright fella. Whenever they give you any of those reading comprehension tests or anything like that, I'm way up there, you know. I got all kinds of knowledge and all that kind of stuff. I just don't have any sense. And I got struck stupid. I was so beaten by this disease that I was willing to do whatever you told me to do. I've had a couple of sponsees like that. Not many. You have to be real careful with them, because if you tell them to do something, they'll do it, you know. And you have to be real specific about what you tell. Well, that's how I was. I was shattered. And so they started pumping the 12 steps into me. They didn't explain the 12 steps to me or what the ramifications of them were or the psychological benefits. They just said, take these. And so I started on this road. About a week after I got sober, Bonnie came back to the house, and I told her what had happened. I explained to her that there was a place for her, and she was just thrilled to hear that. And so she went off to Al-Anon, and I am one of those grateful drunks who has a wife who is an active member of Al-Anon. I want you to know that an Al-Anon member is not someone who is merely married to an alcoholic. That is someone who is an active participant in the Al-Anon program, who works the 12 steps of Al-Anon, who applies the traditions of Al-Anon in her life, and my life is graced by a member of Al-Anon. But I talked to my sponsor and I said, I felt that now that she had her 12-step program and I had my 12-step program, that there was entirely too much damage to have been done, and that the best thing for us to do would be to separate, to divorce and go our separate ways. That we had, you know, that it couldn't possibly be repaired. And he said, you're not going to make any emotional decisions in your first year of sobriety. And I said, what the hell does that mean? And he said, that means you're not going to divorce your wife. You're not going to fall in love with anybody else. You're not going to change jobs. You're not going to move. You're not going to redecorate. You're not going to buy a new car. You're not going to lose 35 pounds. You're not going to quit smoking. You're not going to start jogging 15 miles a day. You're not going to get a hair transplant. You're not going to get your face lifted. You're not going to read any spiritual literature. You're going to put your entire life on hold, and you're going to work the 12 steps, and you're going to get sober, and it takes about a year. And I said, but you don't understand. I'm not sure that I love her. And he said, I don't give a damn about love. Work on good manners. So I started saying please and thank you to my wife. We just celebrated our 24th wedding anniversary. You're going to get to hear her share the Al-Anon speaker on Saturday morning. I was a blackout drinker, so it's always a revelation to hear her speak. The first night that I was sober, my sponsor told me to pick up my ashtray and fold up my chair, and I've been involved in service ever since. By the time I was 3 weeks sober, he turned on me and told me I had 3 weeks to do my fourth step. So since I was only 3 weeks sober, I didn't know you couldn't do it, so I did it. And when I was 6 weeks sober, I took my fifth step. And by that time, I was washing cups. Now, when you wash cups, see, I couldn't do anything without drinking. You don't understand. I mean, how do you make love to your wife sober? How do you go to work sober? And I went to work the day after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I never quit working. I mean, I just went, you know, I didn't know that you could check out for 28 days. I wish I'd have known that. God, you know, I went to work. You know, I went to work in my early days of sobriety, I was in sales. I would go to work and pray that the phone wouldn't ring. Please, God, don't let... And then come home, and I mean, our life was a nightmare at home. And I was working the steps, and I was washing cups. When you wash cups, it's impossible not to talk to the guy who's drying them. You know? You wash the cups, and you have to say, you didn't get that one. And then he says, you know, don't take my inventory. And I say, well, you know, maybe you ought to talk to your sponsor. And you're having a conversation, and you're not drinking. I mean, it's amazing. You know? I always tried to be well-dressed when I went to AA meetings. I always thought that a blazer was suitable protection from anything. And so they asked me to do things. I read chapter 5 when I was about a week sober, and when I sat down, the chairman said it was the first time she'd ever heard it read in one breath. And I am painfully shy. What I've done to overcompensate for that appalls me, but I would really like shyness to be a psychological disorder. I mean, I would really like it to be, I think we should start another 12-step program. I think 385 12-step programs is just not enough. I think we need one more, you know? And I think for shy people, it would be SA, Shy Anonymous, and they'd be real small meetings because people would be too shy to come, you know, and they'd be real quiet because who would speak up? And then I could kind of go through the 12 steps on it again and not really get to it, you know? You know, you can kind of spin this out, you know, all the defects of character. But shyness in my case is not a psychological disorder. Shyness in my case is extreme self-obsession. I'm so concerned with what kind of impression I'm going to make on you when I meet you that I don't move toward you. You know, I found out the tyranny of the passive personality a long time ago. If I stand in a corner over there and read a book and look lost, if you walk over to me, I own you. Walking over to you is hard for me. So what they made me do was shake hands at the door. Now, I would have rather eaten ground glass than shake hands at the door. But it was another one of my jobs, and I would stand there and say, hi, my name is Sean, with this sweating palm, you know, in my blazer that was sticking to my back. And you know, I got to tell you, the wonderful thing in Alcoholics Anonymous is they don't tell you what you're doing and what you're learning. Thank God, because if they did, we'd muck it all up. There's so many of these newcomers now that are spinning off to therapists and counselors and all this kind of stuff in their first couple of years of sobriety. You know, and what they're doing is they're you know what your mother used to say: don't pick at the scab, it'll never heal. Right, you know, there's all these newcomers picking at the scabs, you know. So now they find themselves 6 months sober, knowing every one of their problems, you know, with no way to solve it. The neat thing, we've forgotten some stuff. You know, the old timers used to say, more will be revealed, you know. Sobriety isn't about getting in touch with your emotions. Your emotions get in touch with you quite handily, you know. I have only found out stuff when I was able to deal with it because I've been willing to do it the old-fashioned way, you know, just the 12 steps and stuff. So I didn't realize stuff about myself, you know. But standing at the door and shaking hands, the shyness doesn't go away. You know, it just doesn't go away. Sometimes it just kind of hits you, and I get asked to share from these podiums a lot, you know, and if you recognize my car, what'll happen is I'll drive into the parking lot of a speaker meeting and I'll sit in my car for a while, and you'll think, isn't that wonderful? Sean's getting a spiritual message together. And there I am with 10, 15, 20 years of sobriety sitting there saying, you've got to get out of this car, Sean. I mean, they've seen you. You can't drive away, you know. Yeah. And what I do is I get out of my car and I walk up to the door, and some poor jerk whose sponsor made him do it is standing at the door and he says, hi, my name is Fred and I'm an alcoholic. And what he does is he takes my hand and he pulls me into the room. And he doesn't know he's doing it. And it's an act of love. And you find out that stuff years later. You know, you find out that sweeping floors and washing cups are acts of love, and buying literature and all that kind of stuff. And slowly but surely what they turn us around in this fellowship into is loving human beings. People who become more concerned with other people than with ourselves. When I was 5 years sober, I was very, very sober. I was Captain Sobriety. I was sponsoring guys and talking from podiums and going to meetings and in service and all that kind of stuff. And what happened to me is what happens to a lot of people 5, 6 years sober. And there's not a lot of literature on it. There's a lot of literature on what it's like being sober up to 5 years, because that's what those guys who wrote the big book were. And then there's a bunch of literature later that Bill wrote. But there's a thing that happens to a lot of us, and it's baffling to a lot of us at about this time. But at about 5 years, a lot of us hit a kind of wall, like marathon runners hit. And I didn't know what was happening. I want you to know that all these insights that I'm sharing with you are all hindsights. I have never known what was going on with me at the moment. You know, if you want to know how I'm feeling today, call me in a week in Vancouver and I'll tell you how I was in West Palm Beach, you know, but I haven't got a clue right now. And the longer I'm sober, it's less and less interesting to me how I feel and more important how I act. But when I was 5 years sober, I was sober enough, I felt, and I didn't know this really, that I started exploring the fence lines of my sobriety. What happens about that time if you've been active in this fellowship, if you've been working the steps and getting some kind of comprehension of the traditions and being active, is you start a lot of the defects of character, a lot of them just melt away because you're not drinking, and then there are those ones that God just lifts like a sliver, you know. And then there's the ones that he cuts out of us with a dull stone knife with no anesthetic. And those are the ones that I have defined as my coping skills, my survival mechanisms, my charm, my ability to get ahead. Because sooner or later, we've got to abandon everything in order to function in this world. We've got to take that seven-step prayer at depth. And I hadn't done it at depth when I was 5 years sober. And so I started looking at the edges. I was finding out how much rope I had before I would hang myself. And what happened is I ended up getting arrested again, cold sober. It's not as much fun when you're Captain Sobriety to be fingerprinted and photographed and released on your own recognizance. I went home that night and I sat down. And for the first time in my life ever, I thought of suicide. Seriously, seriously considered suicide. I was not going to drink. I was not going to give the ones satisfactions that I didn't like in the program. I was going to stay sober, man, but I was going to kill myself. But, you know, I was taught some stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought it was silly stuff. I was taught things, we were talking about this, I was taught that if you weren't a half an hour early for a meeting, you were late. Because stuff happens before meetings. People talk to each other before meetings. People talk to each other after meetings, you know? You hear people getting coffee. My life has been changed by old-timers talking to each other at the coffee machine when I happen to be standing nearby, you know? And I've never left a meeting before keep coming back at the end of the Lord's Prayer. No matter how boring the speaker was, no matter how much I knew the real story of the speaker who was speaking, you know? Because I was taught that kind of respect for the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And also I was told that I would hear things that would get stored away for when I needed them later. And that night, when I had decided I was going to kill myself, I remembered something that I'd heard in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I remembered that I did not want to kill the man. I just wanted to kill the moment. And that if I would be very still, the moment would pass. And so I tried to get as still as I could. Bonnie came home from her Al-Anon meeting and walked into the kitchen and across the room and said, "My God, what's happened?" And I told her. And the miracle of Al-Anon had happened because she didn't start screaming. She didn't start saying, "What are you doing to my life? What are you doing to our marriage? What are you doing?" She didn't start doing that or making threats or anything else. What she did was she sat down opposite the table and she looked at me for a long, long time. And then she reached across the table and put her hand in my face and said, "Oh, Sean, I am so sorry you have to hurt yourself so much." And after a while, she said to me, "Sean, there are two things that I require in order to stay married to you. I need your fidelity and your loyalty. And if you can give me those things, I will stay married to you because I love you. If you can't give me those things, I have to leave because I love you." And so I had to make a choice. And I went to my sponsor and did some more writing and some more work and started to go back again over the 12 steps at a very, very deep level and started to integrate the 12 traditions into my life. At that time, I started also getting actively involved in general service. I went to the bathroom at a business meeting and became the GSR.
Yeah. I'm the what?
Yeah. But an incredible thing happened out of that experience. Getting involved in general service, a very, very important thing happened to me. I realized that while my sobriety was a central issue of my life, that your sobriety collectively was more important than mine was. That I could not survive without your sobriety. That I could not survive without your dedication to service. And that I hoped that I would catch the fever. And so we started reconstructing our lives and started reconstructing our marriage. And we got to some areas and some problems that were very, very deep and very, very frightening. And we worked through them with the help of people in this fellowship. I have always gone to the resources that are available here. When I wanted to stay married, I went to the people who were married for a long time and said, "How do you do it?" And they taught us how you do it. And then Bonnie got pregnant. And I started going to the fathers in Alcoholics Anonymous and saying, "How do you do this?" And they started to teach me. And when I was 8 years sober, Kate was born. She's running around here this weekend because you had the grace to ask us to bring her with us, and I want to thank you for that. It was really wonderful. She's 13 now. Last year came the moment, you know. 12-year-old boys and 12-year-old girls look alike. I mean, they all got ponytails, they all got earrings, they all wear these great big huge sweatshirts and baggy pants and these horrible clunky shoes, and they all look alike, you know. And last year before school, Kate said, "Dad, I need to go shopping, so let's go shopping." Now, Kate is smart enough to ask Dad to go shopping, because when she goes shopping with Mom, Mom says, "How much is that?" And Dad says, "How many colors does it come in?" So we go shopping. So we're at the Gap, and I got this terrific sales lady who's got two teenage sons, and we're talking about, you know, entering puberty and all this kind of stuff. And Kate said, "Can I try this on, Dad?" And I said, "Sure." So she went off to the dressing room, and I'm standing there talking, and out she comes from the dressing room in a ribbed turtleneck. Now, underneath all going on, and she walks out in this tight ribbed turtleneck, and like this 15-year-old pimply-faced kid walks by and checks her out. And I say to the sales lady, "Vests! Where are the vests?" And she says, "Calm down, Dad." So we get home from shopping, and Bonnie goes through the bag and says, "You paid $58 for a vest." And I said, "I don't want to talk about it. She's never worn the vest. You know, there are little tiny things in sobriety that you're not aware of. That are huge miracles, that are huge things that happen in just the flash of an eye in seconds. Kate went to her first dance not long ago, and she got a new little outfit. She went upstairs to change, and she came down, and she had a little short skirt on, you know, little heels and a little top, and her hair all done. And she's beautiful. She's just beautiful, you know. And she kind of came into the kitchen, and I looked at her, and I went, you know. And that instant happened that happens for every father, because you've told me about it, when you realize they're not a little girl anymore. You know, when you realize that the relationship has now shifted, and it can never shift back. That there was a moment when she has to be treated differently, that she has to be hugged differently and touched differently, and we don't wrestle and all, you know, all that kind of stuff. You know? And I got so grateful to this fellowship that I'm sober, you know, because if I had been standing in the kitchen reaching for a beer in the refrigerator, I might have missed it and something awful might have happened. You know? But because I'm cold sober and aware of everything and aware of what you've taught me, that moment when the relationship changed just happened in the kitchen and nobody knew about it except me, and it was wonderful. 7-8 years ago, we got the opportunity to move to Vancouver from Los Angeles, and it's been a terrific move for us. And my brother and I and a couple of partners started a very, very successful company, and I got to do some things that I had always dreamed about. And about 6 years ago, I had probably the most extraordinary moment in my life where I participated in something I'd always wanted to do. I had the most success I'd ever had in my life. And at the same time, I was diagnosed with skin cancer. The yin and the yang, you know. And so we started the process of checking me out. So I go every 6 months and they get the melon scoop and they take little bits and pieces away from me and, you know. And I've got interesting little kind of scars and things. And my body's starting to look like a railroad map of New Jersey now. And I've always said I've had to give up the night job with Strippogram. But but things were going really kind of well, and then things started going very difficultly. And 2.5 years ago, I left that company and started out on my own. And I'm here to report to you that, you know, sobriety is not the absence of problems. I had kind of thought at one time in my sobriety that if I sponsored enough guys and went to enough meetings and did enough kind of good works and service, that I would eventually get to the place where I didn't feel anything. You know, it was kind of like sobriety would be like a giant Darvon where I could just kind of, you know, not, you know, big sober Thorazine here, you know. Well, what happens with sobriety is it makes you probably hypersensitive to what's going on around you. And my threshold for pain has gone way down. And over the last 2.5 years, I have had some spectacular business failures. I mean, just really unbelievably. Nothing sudden, just those kind of grinding ones, you know, those slow, god-awful ones where it slowly falls apart. During that time, Bonnie was out in the backyard gardening. Well, let me explain that. Al-Anons do not garden; they farm. And so she was hauling a tree root out by her bare hands and ruptured a disc in the back of her neck. And what happened was, in order to avoid surgery, she had to go to bed. Now, let me tell you, a helpless Al-Anon is not a pretty sight. Oh, no, no, no. I mean, you guys are terrific at taking care of us, just lousy at being taken care of. And so when she would be feeling a little better, she would do too much and then, you know, be back on her flat on her back. And finally, the doctor said, you got to go to bed or you will, you know, essentially lose the use of your arms. And so she was flat on her back. And what happened is our relationship shifted. God is absolutely amazing, you know. It's a long, long time. A lot of those character defects take a long time to go away. And a lot of trust takes a long time to build. And I suppose what we hit was the last point, you know. Because see, whenever I had trouble with work or anything, Bonnie could always get a job. Well, suddenly she was not capable of doing that and my business was failing. And she had to rely on me. She had to rely on Kate and I to take care of everything. We had to clean the house and do dishes and cook and get her up and get her down and get her dressed and everything else. And it was a terrifying time for her. But you know, I got to tell you something. I'm here to report that sober guys step up to the plate. You know, sometimes we strike out, but by God, we step up to the plate. And that's not like me. I'm a drunk that's faced with problems. I run, man. I'm out of here. I'm onto a new place, a new person, a new job, a new something. But I didn't run. I said, we're going to get through this, and we are. And so we did, you know. Last year, Bonnie decided she was bored with being around the house, so she thought she would get some practice out there in the work world. And so she found an ad, and we typed up a resume, and she sent it in, and they interviewed her 3 times and gave her the job. Now, I am sending resumes out all over the country. I mean, they're going out. I mean, you know, a couple of dozen, you know, well, no, a dozen jobs I've applied for, and some of them they haven't even responded. And I got to tell you, it is really tough. It is really tough because a lot of my self-worth is tied up with what I do. It's real, you know, it's real. I have an office at home, and I've got those discipline things that I'm trying to do. I get up at 7 o'clock. I get in the shower. I get dressed. I go into my office. I close the door. I make my phone calls. I wait for the return calls. I resist watching the OJ trial. You know, I just, you know. And she comes home from work tired and sometimes irritable, and I, you know, and I'm making beds and cooking lousy meals and you know, just trying like mad to be okay with this stuff. And I, you know, it has been really, really tough. And I had lunch a couple of weeks ago with a guy I sponsored who at 10 years of sobriety decided that he was clinically depressed and has gone on Prozac, and he's just happy as a pig in shit. And he doesn't work either. But he's feeling real good about it. And so we talked about this, and he went over a questionnaire that he'd gotten from his doctor about depression, and we went over the questions, you know. And I qualify for moderate to mid depression. You know, I'm clinically depressed according to this little questionnaire, you know, suitable for medication. Yeah. And there are days when I just fight not going to bed for a week. You know, I would just love to just not get up. Just not. And I used to do that when I was drinking. You know, I'd just spend a week in bed. But the reason I don't do it is because Alcoholics Anonymous works. The reason I don't do it is because Alcoholics Anonymous has provided victories and miracles in my life beyond anything that I ever dreamed of. And I am slogging, trudging through this particular aspect, the painful aspect of my life. And I'm doing it cold sober, and I'm talking about it whenever I'm asked to share, because I am not going to deny myself a victory at the end of this. You know? I'm not going to alleviate this pain artificially so that when it's all removed, I won't even notice that it's gone. Because that's what life is about. We live in a society that doesn't want us to feel any pain. We live in a society that doesn't want us to be upset. Well, I got to tell you something. This group of people lives in a society that understands that pain is the touchstone of growth. We live in a group of people that understand that if I can walk through this pain and not drink and not use, that you pick up a little hope so that you can do it too. I live in a society where people got up at these podiums and talked about stuff that was killing them and that they were cold sober, and I knew if they can do it, I can do it. And what I got to tell you is, no matter how terrified you are, there are the resources here. There is everything here that you need. I am really, really lucky. My sponsor taught me that for every one of my problems, we would work the 12 steps first, and if that didn't work, we would seek professional help. And I'm 21 years, 3 months, and 3 days sober, and I've never sought professional help because every one of my problems have gotten solved here. And I've had what would seem to be massive problems to people out there. In here, they're just kind of, you know, what's going on, you know? The wonderful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is Alcoholics Anonymous has made me useful, and I think that's the most important thing about me, is that I'm no longer kind of not very needed, you know? Alcoholics Anonymous is a tribe. And if you look at Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you've ever studied anthropology, it's practically a classic tribe. What it is it originally was a small group of people who gathered together to protect themselves from what was a hostile world. And that's what it was like in the early days. You know, people who didn't understand alcoholism or didn't understand why we didn't need a drink or couldn't do it on our own, we would gather together. And in a tribe, which is a small group of people and has a very fragile existence, everybody is made useful. Nobody in the tribe just gets to sit around. We all get jobs. And you see them. You see them in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, they're the fuel gatherers, you know, the ones who keep the fires lit. Those are the ones that open up the meeting places and make sure that the chairs are set up, you know. And then there are the people who get on the bus and get the literature and bring it back. And there are the mothers and the fathers who nurture us and teach us. And there are the warriors who protect the tribe. And they're the ones in general service who protect the traditions so that we've got it. And there are the scouts that go to different tribes and come back and say, it's okay, it's the same. You can go there and be all right. And there are the shamans. They're the ones that have been here for a long, long time who have accumulated the only thing that is of any worth here, and that's sober experience. Psychological talk and religious dogma is fine, you know, but the thing that I need to know is how do you stay sober through this thing, and these shamans, the old ones, tell us. And there are the storytellers, and the storytellers are the ones who tell their stories, and that's what I've been this afternoon, and I'm honored to do that. And I got to tell you that I have found a God in Alcoholics Anonymous, a God that I'm comfortable with and that I live with an ease. I've been raised with a God that was out there and up there that was a combination of Genghis Khan and Santa Claus, who didn't particularly like me but was willing to make a deal. And since I've come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I've found out that there's a God that doesn't care whether I'm good or bad, that doesn't care whether I'm drunk or sober, that just cares because that's God's job description. And I have found out that there are no good people or bad people. I have found out that there are people who know and people who don't know. And the people who know what I need to know are in these rooms. And so I keep coming back to them. And I believe that we are created in the image and likeness of God. I don't believe it's the way we look. I believe it's the way we act. And I can see God in you when you act the way you do. I can see the family resemblance to God. I can see it when a little old lady says to some 15-year-old punk kid with a safety pin through her nose and her hair dyed green, come and sit next to me, dear. I can see it when the guy gets on the bus and goes across town and buys the literature and then gets on the bus and comes back. I can see it when the woman gets there 2 hours early and puts the coffee on so that it's there when the meeting starts. I can see the family resemblance. I can see it, the ones washing cups. I can see it all over the place. And I keep coming back because these are the places where the miracles are. I keep coming back because it is a privilege to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to thank you for the privilege of being here to share. I really needed to be here. I really needed to let you know that when the rain falls, it falls on sober people too. I also need you to know that when the sun shines, it shines on sober people too. And then I'm waiting. I'm waiting for this area of my life to get cleaned up. And I know it will, because I know this passes. And I know that the next time I see you, I'll probably be okay, you know, in this area. I probably need to work on something else. But I want to thank you. I really want to thank you for allowing me to be here. I salute you, and I thank you for your lives. God bless you.